This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. On this episode, we hear about the momentum being gained by the student loan strike debt movement. But first, we speak with Preston Wood, member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. He discusses the recent Supreme Court decision making same-sex marriage legal in the U.S. We discuss how such a ruling seemed impossible just a few years ago, but was able to be won by a people's movement, and what it means for the LGBTQ community going forward. All right, Preston, it's easy now to lose sight of the sea and change in social attitudes the marriage equality ruling reflects. Can you tell us about how you came into the movement fighting for equality and the obstacles faced by LGBTQ people at that time?
Sure, and thanks for having me on your show. It's great. I was an activist pretty early in my life, but I was mainly involved with the civil rights movement because, you know, that's when in the 50s, when I was a young person, I was very involved in the struggle against segregation. At the same time, I knew I was gay, but I didn't feel any connection to a political movement, and all my energy was directed at fighting against all the Jim Crow laws because I grew up in a southern area of the state of Illinois. Then it was later in life when I began to see the connections, and when the LGBTQ movement started to expand, I was ready for that. I went through a whole process of having to live kind of underground and just focus my energies on the civil rights movement. But then as I grew and developed as an activist and then finally embraced the revolutionary path of socialism, I struggled very hard to find ways of integrating that into the overall broad mass struggle, progressive struggle for equality and civil rights for everyone.
The organizations, including those demanding marriage equality, focusing on LGBTQ issues, began at very grassroots levels. Can you reflect on that as well?
Well, sure. If you look at the early uprisings and rebellions, of course, the most famous one is the Stonewall Rebellion in New York City in 1969, where grassroots people, mainly oppressed street people and transgender people and gay men and lesbians and people who were coming into Greenwich Village just to have a sanctuary from the outside world, a hostile world. Those were the people who started the fight, who actually reached a point where they said, we are sick and tired of being pushed around by the police, of being harassed and beaten up, and we're going to make a stand. So that's really what ignited the modern movement for lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer rights. And it was those people coming into the streets who really fought hard and who helped define the goal of reaching equality and equal treatment under the law and under the Constitution. Before the big groups came into being, the big well-funded, connected to the Democratic Party, there were still thousands and then eventually hundreds of thousands and millions of people who started to come together and fight and to identify issues where they could organize, change things, be in the streets, confront bigotry, confront the police, confront the laws. And it developed into a huge, huge movement. In 1979 was the first national march for lesbian gay rights. And that was Oddly enough, only that short time ago, not one liberal politician, not one person outside of the movement except the left and the socialist, some aspects of the socialist movement, came and expressed their solidarity. It was 100,000 people. It was a very, it was only 10 years after the Stonewall Rebellion, and already we had a movement that national where people came from all over the country to take a stand in front of Congress, in front of the White House, saying we're fed up, we want equal rights, and we're tired of being discriminated against.
And can you speak to the impact the marriage equality ruling will have on the LGBTQ people in working class and oppressed communities?
Yes, so the recent ruling, I mean, who would have dreamed just a few months ago or a few years ago that such a ruling would occur at this time by the Supreme Court. In 1986, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the reactionary sodomy laws that were in existence in 13 states. The whole ruling establishment of the United States was silent on the issue of not just marriage equality, but just equality for LGBTQ people. So this has like come about because of the strength of the movement, which has expanded and grown so much, which has attracted so many supporters, and has also allied with other progressive movements, the movements against racism, the movement against war, the women's movement. All these movements helped build a movement that would change public opinion to the point where the Supreme Court really didn't have a choice but to rule in favor because of the old sea change in public opinion. And where did this sea change come from? It didn't come from the politicians. It came from the people. It came from street-based actions, demonstrations small and large, in cities small and large, people taking a stand, people coming together, people demanding equality. So obviously, this is a huge sea change, not just for the LGBTQ community, but for all progressive movements, that history is made in the streets by mass movements. The Voting Rights Act came about because millions of people stood with the black community against racism and discrimination. We won Roe v. Wade because people came into the streets and fought for reproductive rights for women. And the same thing with any other movement you look at. The changes come from below, from the people, and they're not a benevolent just gift that's given by the politicians. The politicians, many of whom just a short time ago, including the Clinton dynasty, not to mention the Bush dynasty, you know, suddenly they're pandering to rights, and we're glad they are. But it came about because they saw millions of people saying, we're really sick of gay bashing, we're tired of transgender bashing, we're tired of all the hatred. I think that's what's really a very hopeful sign, because this will strengthen the ongoing tasks of continuing to fight for equality, continuing to fight for an end to police harassment and for bigotry, and move the movement forward. Not just that movement, but all the progressive movements can see that, yes, it is possible to change things. The idea that is always being promoted in the media that why bother to demonstrate? Nothing is going to change. Well, things have definitely changed when you find marriage equality being recognized as the law of the land in the United States. And that's an irrefutable fact, and it's a very exciting one because it shows us we can do this. If we unite, if we fight together against wherever working class people, oppressed people are under attack, this is where we have to stand together and say, no, an injury to one is an injury to all. We're not going to stand for this. And together, you know, we're going to say, back off. We're going to stand up and fight for our rights.
That's right. And continuing that fight, how does the marriage equality ruling help open the door to keep pushing for the rights of LGBTQ people? And what are some of the things we should focus on specifically to keep fighting for?
Well, that's a really good question, Sean. It's happened when Obama was elected. There were certain people saying that we now live in a post-racism society. We know that is so not true. Black people are being targeted by by right-wing terrorists, by the police. The ruling administration of this country is doing nothing to stop it. And the same thing goes for the gay issue, because there are still so many areas of where poor and oppressed LGBTQ people are still under attack. In Los Angeles, the incidents of brutality, of violence against trans people, transgender people, increased 46% in just the last year. So the bigoted forces, the thugs, the fascist right-wing forces are going out and seeking to burn black churches, to attack transgender people and vulnerable people they perceive as being gay. People who are non-gender conforming are being targeted. So we still have a big fight on our hands. It's just that this ruling gives us this is a validation of everything we're doing, and showing us if we keep fighting, we can keep marching towards real equality for everyone, and including those who are poor, living in the poor areas of the country, those who are black, Latino, Asian, who are targeted, the drag queens, the transgender people, the gender nonconforming people. We have to right now stand with them, because that's an arena where people are under attack. And so rather than say, cross our, just sit down and fold our arms and say, we did it, we have to say, no, we have to stay out fighting for these things. There's so many issues that are not resolved yet. We haven't defeated the right-wing bigots. We haven't defeated the hypocritical fundamentalist churches. We have to fight harder for real equality. Another issue is trans people and LGBTQ people who are undocumented immigrants who are being taken into the detention centers and brutalized and beaten up by the guards and some of the more thug prisoners. So we have a lot of work to do, but this shows how we can carry out the struggle and we can win the equality that we've been fighting so hard for. We're not going to stop.
And Preston, we have a few more minutes here. Can you talk mm-hmm. about for socialists, what should be our key takeaway from the Supreme Court ruling?
Well, yes, I am a socialist. I'm a proud member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. I saw early on in my political development that to have real permanent change, guaranteed rights for everything, we need a revamp of the system. We need a systemic change from a profit system which feeds and tries to divide and tries to isolate people so they're under attack. We need the opposite. We need a workers' government where the rights of everyone are held together. So while we're doing that, and the way to do that is to engage in struggles for rights, for transitional demands where we fight for equality in order to get people in the streets so they can see and get them organized so they can see, too, who the enemy is, who the problem is in the system, and who their allies are. So that's why, as socialists, we want to move the ball forward on the playing field and to mobilize people and to show in the process what the real solutions are, the long-term solutions that are needed in order to win and maintain true equality for people in a system that thrives on cooperation, respect, rather than division and brutality. And this is why it's such an encouraging moment for those of us who are in the socialist movement, and why we, without any unconditional support for groups that are fighting for their rights against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all the other evils of imperialist war that are part of the capitalist profit system package. So we think that this is a lesson that everyone, we can go to people and say, you see, we are the real power. We are the ones who produce the wealth. We are the ones who can run society. We do. It's just that our labor is being exploited and misused in so many ways. We need to unite and turn all the wealth and resources that we create and that are part of our planet under the control of a workers' government, and so that we can really change the landscape, literally including the ticking clock of what's happening to our planet and the environment based on profits. So it's all, everything is connected, and that's why as socialists we support demands such as equality, civil rights, whatever the struggles are, we throw our energy into it and support them just to move the struggle forward and to help win rights. But we won't win rights permanently until we have a people's government, a people's, a workers' government that represents the interests of the workers. We fought very hard for, workers fought and died for the eight-hour day, for Medicare, for Social Security. Now, as you can see, they're trying to like dismantle those and take them away from us. So we have to we have to remain in the streets and active in order to secure the things that we deserve and need, and to take the money out of the pockets of the 1% and return it to the 99%.
Thank you so much, Preston.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Next, we listen to part one of an interview with Alexis Goldstein of Strike Debt. She speaks about the growing movement to push back the largest debt of the land, U.S. student debt.
We are here on Liberation Radio with Alexis Goldstein, a member of the Debt Collective, an organizer with the Debt Collective, and we'll get into all the different things that they do. But Alexis, first and foremost, thank you so much for joining us here on Liberation Radio.
Eugene, thanks so much for having me on.
So the issue of student debt is really one of the most significant issues, obviously, in the country. We saw it pop up in the last two presidential elections. But for our readers who, or listeners, I should say, who are unsure, what's the scope of the debt problem? What's the scale of the debt problem? How big is this?
So Americans owe $1.2 trillion in student debt currently, and that number is predicted by the think tank Demos to climb to $2 trillion by 2025. And then in terms of the burden on the people that have that debt, we've seen warnings from really establishment organizations like the Federal Reserve, that's not really known for being very radical. They have warned that all of this student debt poses a risk to the economy, and it poses a risk because, quite frankly, people aren't able to take out mortgages to own their own home anymore because they are so burdened by student debt. Another just number to throw out there, the government agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, has estimated that about 8 million Americans are in default on their student loans. So there's this essentially invisible army of people that don't have enough money to pay their loans and are in default. I could go on, but that's a little taste of where we're at in terms of student debt in this country.
Well, you know, and perhaps this will give you a chance to go on. I think another issue is when we talk in the trillions, that's quite a bit of money. And I'm curious, how important is student debt to the banking industry?
I think it is less important than it used to be. It used to be that private companies guaranteed student loans. So what that means is, who pays up if somebody defaults and is never able to pay. That used to be work done by private companies. And since 2010, the federal government has actually taken on that role. And so in some ways, it's somewhat less important than it used to be. But that said, there is still a very large private student loan market, right? So you can only get so much money in federal student loans. There are limits. And so the latest estimate that I've seen is that there's $165 billion in the private student loan market. So, you know, JP Morgan Chase used to make student loans, Wells Fargo, and then there are all manner of other private companies. So it's pretty significant. It's somewhat less significant than it used to be, but $165 billion, that's not anything to sneeze at.
That's certainly not small change. Is there any particular reason why it's shifted more to the government? Is it just the market dynamics after the fall, or is there something more significant going on there?
I think it was a sort of an explicit policy choice, and I guess I I think that it's not necessarily the worst idea, right? Like, because in some ways it's a reverse of what we usually see, right? We usually see neoliberalism marching on and turning more things from the government over to the private sector. But I'm sort of opposed to the idea of student debt to begin with, right? I think we should be providing free college and free education at the higher education level. So I'm not sure it's that good of a thing, but maybe it's a tiny step in the right direction. But yeah, I believe it was just a policy choice that this is just something that the government can do, and there's no reason that we should be relying on private institutions to do it.
Mm-hmm. And put a pin on that free college piece. I want to come back to that. But speaking of government responsibility or complicity or however you want to put it, we've seen a number of initiatives coming out of the Obama administration in the wake of the scandal around Corinthian, which is a for-profit college. Could you just tell our listeners a little bit about what happened there at Corinthian first and foremost?
So Corinthian Colleges was one of the largest for-profit college chains in the country. And these were schools, they were made up of three schools, Everest, Wyotech, and Heald. And Everest in particular was really famous for their commercials on television, because they would say things like, hey, get off the couch, call this number right now and sign up. It's so easy. You can go back to school. You can get a better job. Do something with your life. They were almost sort of like shaming people and trying to say, what are you doing? You're just sitting there watching TV. And so these schools have been investigated by various federal regulators and also state attorneys general since 2007. And they were basically a scam school that would lie about the kinds of jobs that people would get after they went to it. They were incredibly expensive. We're talking like, you know, $20,000, $30,000 a year. And the quality of the education was terrible. Most people figured out after they went to Everest that it was such an embarrassing stain on their resume and employers didn't recognize the degree that it was better to leave it off of their degree. And they did a whole host of illegal things, everything from using military logos in their advertising, which you're not allowed to do, to securities fraud. They were sued by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau for predatory lending. Anything you can pretty much think about that a school could do that was illegal, Corinthian did. But all of this was happening while the Department of Education continued to let federal student loan money go to this school, about $1 billion a year, sometimes more than $1 billion a year. So even though there had been all these lawsuits going back to 2007, it was only in 2014 the Department of Education started saying, maybe we should do something about this Corinthian school. It seems to be getting into a lot of trouble.
Interesting. Well, and now that they've decided to do something, that's certainly been the topic of discussion. Could you explain some of the initiatives that have come out of the Department of Education, I believe?
Sure. So what essentially happened is Corinthian collapsed under the weight of all of these lawsuits that I mentioned. The Department of Ed finally started to limit the amount of federal student loan money that could go to the school last summer, the summer of 2014. The minute that they did that, the school began to teeter. And so the Department of Ed actually gave it a temporary $15 billion emergency cash infusion, aka a bailout, so that the school could stay alive long enough for the department to facilitate a sale to another company. But the problem is, even though the department finally acknowledged after all of these years of burying their head in the sand that this school was misrepresenting job placements, was giving people not the education that they promised, violating all these laws, these students still owe a lot of debt. At least $3.5 billion worth of debt to this school that the Department of Education has now called the payday lender of education. And so even though the department started to do some very small things to shut down the flow of federal money to this school, what has happened since is a lot of groups like the Debt Collective has been pushing for the Department of Education to cancel all of the student debt for all Corinthian students who ever attended the school, and use all of the evidence compiled by all of these lawsuits in order to make that determination and to cancel the debt. So little known fact, the Department of Education has right now, without having to ask Congress for anything, the authority to cancel debt. They have several different parts of the law that allow them to do that. And they could, with the stroke of a pen, essentially wipe out debt if they believe that the school violated state law, which Corinthian definitely did and has been demonstrated over and over again. So we have been pushing, and first 15 students, then 100 students, and now 200 students at Corinthian basically said, we're tired of waiting for the Department of Education. We are going on strike. And we will not pay our federal student loans because you've told us that Corinthian is a scam school, but you're still collecting on our debt. Why are you doing that? So earlier this month, the department announced that some students would get a fast track process to debt cancellation, about 40,000 students who attended Heald College. But all the students that went to Everest and Wyotech, which had just as bad conduct as this Heald school, have a much more complicated process. They have to apply individually. They have to cite state law, which assumes that these students are lawyers. And these students aren't lawyers. They went to Everest. They went to Wyotech, which are vocational schools. So they were studying things like medical assistant or nursing or computer technical degrees. And they weren't even trained in that, let alone being trained as lawyers. So the department is sort of taking like one small step to let some Heald students get debt cancellation and essentially forcing hundreds of thousands of other students to jump through a bunch of flaming hoops in order to apply for debt cancellation. And then some person at the Department of Ed will decide whether or not on a case-by-case basis to give people debt cancellation. But the interesting thing, and I think the thing that we've been able to learn from this process and educate the public about, is, hey, this law exists. The Department of Education can cancel debt if they find there to be vast fraud at a school. And that's an important thing to know going forward.
That's all for Liberation Radio. I'm Sean Garcia. Please remember this program is available free for broadcast by community and public radio stations. You can encourage your local radio station to air Liberation Radio. They can visit liberationradio.org for details. Tune in next week for more from the Struggle for Justice.
You have been listening to Liberation Radio, a weekly program from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can find us online at liberationradio.org to listen to past shows and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Some of what you heard during this program are Creative Commons licensed compositions. Our theme music and some music segments were performed by Six Fingers and used with permission of the artist. Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation to help build the struggle for socialism in the United States. The PSL is a party of activists and organizers. We are in the streets at the demonstrations and picket lines, opposing cutbacks and attacks on workers, standing up to police brutality, fighting for immigrant rights, and struggling against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all forms of bigotry. We stand in solidarity with oppressed peoples around the world resisting imperialism. We believe the crimes of capitalism call for a new kind of society, and we are committed to fighting for it. To find a PSL branch near you, see our upcoming events and learn more about how you can get involved. PSLweb.org. Again, that's PSLweb.org. Also, the PSL's Liberation newspaper online at liberationnews.org, where you can read our news articles and analysis or purchase a subscription to the print edition. Thank you for listening.